You're listening to Last Word Radio, where you get the last word.
Hello and welcome into the 24th iteration of the Coast to Coast Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Craycraft, and I'm thrilled to be joined back again from the dead by Dante Guarneri. How are you, Dante?
I'm alive, but unfortunately one of the greatest stories in high school basketball history. It's from my great state of New Jersey. St. Anthony's has gone to the grave, closing today. Very sad news for that school. But good news for my high school, who will now happily take any transfer from St. Anthony's.
Yeah, they are no more. Legendary coach Bob Hurley. And alongside this New Jersey-loving man, we're joined again by Thomas Titley, the proud Canadian. He is on cloud nine right now after his beloved North Carolina Tar Heels win the national championship over Gonzaga in what was a weird game for sure, and I think that's right where we're gonna get to. Later in the show, we will jump into some NBA draft stuff and then some NBA playoff stuff, but we got to talk about the Natty. And that belonged to North Carolina as they defeated Gonzaga by a final score of 71-65. The story of the night on Twitter, at least, was mostly ref-related, and I don't know how much we should talk about that because it was painful, and I've heard everyone else and their mother talk about it. So, but Thomas, just tell me how you're feeling and if the joy is still upon you.
Oh, I was jumping around like a lunatic. I think my brother likened it to Michael Jordan when he hit the shot against Utah. I did that kind of jump when we got that breakaway dunk at the end. Yeah, that's how I felt. It was not a pretty game to watch, but it was just an old school game. People can get on the refs, and they blew a lot of calls. I thought they were a little too trigger happy, but I mean they blew calls both ways. It did seem to tend to lean toward UNC a little bit, but I mean I can't really complain about it.
No, you certainly can't. And I guess we can jump back a little bit before we completely break down that game. And there were two Final Four games on Saturday. The first one was Gonzaga over South Carolina, and Gonzaga just came out and hit shots at the beginning, and then they kind of slowed down. The crowd really got behind South Carolina in Arizona, and they rode that momentum as far as they could, but ultimately Gonzaga was too balanced of a team, and they were just able to outwit and outwill the first time Final Four Gamecocks.
Yeah, it was finally the end of the road for the Cinderella story. You really saw how good Gonzaga was and how deep they were in that game. That amazing defense of South Carolina, where they just, it doesn't seem real what their game plan is. It's just deny every pass. But when you have a person who can score at literally every position, and then a couple guys coming off the bench who can do that, which is what Gonzaga has, it's nearly impossible to do that, because then you're overplaying, and that's generally what happened. None of the other teams that South Carolina played had a guy each position that if he had the ball, he could beat his man one-on-one. And so it wasn't necessarily that South Carolina was bad. Gonzaga just showed how good they were.
Yeah, no, and I'd agree with that. I think the one thing that perhaps hampered Gonzaga, and something that maybe should have been a bigger sign going into the UNC game, was just the number of fouls from their big men, from Karnowski, from Collins. In that game, it was Perkins that ended up fouling out. But how big of a role does that play as far as for college basketball teams in their ability to play defense? Why is it that they can't deny in a way that isn't necessarily a foul? Why are they always prone to more fouls than perhaps their NBA counterparts or players that are just higher quality?
I just, for me, I think it's just that these guys you hear it all the time. Freshmen and sophomore big men, they're always in foul trouble. They rarely play over 22 or so minutes a game because they're always prone to that, and they jump and block shots in not the most efficient way. And I think that's pretty much the difference. And then for a guy like Karnowski, who's been there for a while and he doesn't have that same excuse, I just think that people just barrel towards him, and he doesn't have the athleticism to adjust in the air and stuff. So you're gonna get called for the foul 4 times a game when you're doing that 16 times a game.
I mean, we tend to overlook, but North Carolina and Gonzaga were the top two in drawing fouls in the whole tournament. So they draw fouls as well. It wasn't just the fact that they were really touchy. Most of them were legitimate fouls. I found the youth of some of the Gonzaga bigs in both the South Carolina and the North Carolina game showed a little bit. It's Collins. He's a great player. If he came back, which I don't know if he will, if he came back, that would be huge for that program. And then with Karnowski, I agree completely with Austin. He's too slow. And when you have a guy like Joel Berry, who's really quick, barreling down on him, he doesn't have time to position himself properly.
Right. And then in the other semifinal game on that Saturday was North Carolina, Oregon. And it was a tough pill to swallow for me, for sure. There were a lot of takeaways from that one. I don't know even where to start, but because I could spend 20 minutes talking about this game, but I don't really want to, because there's much more interesting things to talk about. But you saw what really kept Oregon in the game was their ability to draw fouls off North Carolina. They finished, I believe, 25 of 28 from the free throw line. Dorsey was 12 for 12 from there, and he showed that ability. And then Jordan Bell played a great 39 minutes and 45 seconds. And he took the blame for the loss, even though I don't think it's his fault whatsoever. I just think that North Carolina really only had 2 players that played well, and they played extremely well in Kennedy Meeks and Justin Jackson. But those 2 players were better than Oregon basically having 1.5 good players on the night.
So partially why I brought up the foul situation, and even considering these teams as Gonzaga and North Carolina as teams that do well in drawing fouls, this still reminds me that this is a college basketball and not professional basketball. I mean, when you think about the end of that game, the fact that they missed 4 free throws in a row from 2 of the players that I believe you just said were the 2 best in the, or you said Jackson, right? But
yeah, in the Oregon game.
Yeah, but at the very least, you know, you put 2 of your better players. You put Meeks at the line. You put Berry at the line. They go up and they whiff 4 free throws in a row. I mean, even to double on that, the fact that they were able to rebound the ball and win the game just reminds me that you know, maybe I'm happier that I'm usually covering professionals at this sport than necessarily the college players.
To be fair, to the end of that game, the 2 guys that were probably 2 of our top 3 players over the year, but Joel Berry had 2 bum ankles. No, that's not an excuse for missing free throws. But Kennedy Meeks is actually one of the worst free throw shooters on that team. Over the year, I believe he only shot 62%. He shot well in the tournament, but he was not consistent throughout the whole year. And nerves really do play a big part at the end of those games, and that showed with those last 4 shots.
Yeah, and I just want to get my stamp on this, that I'm fully on the Tony Bradley bandwagon. I'm all aboard that sucker, as he put up 11 rebounds in the 2 games, and he's so, when you see, it's so crazy seeing him in person. He is so long. Like, they had Pritchard and Benson inbounding a couple times, and they would put him on there, and they didn't have anywhere to go with it. But yes, the Oregon Ducks did lose to North Carolina by a score of 77-76, and that did lead to Monday night's championship game. And as we kind of put a wrap on the season as a whole, I think it's funny that a team like North Carolina ended up winning it, because I think their best basketball was actually played in November at the Maui Invitational, which is pretty weird. There wasn't, you typically you see the teams crescendoing into the national to their best basketball, but North Carolina didn't seem to do that, and it didn't seem like anyone was really, I think the only team that really was playing their best come the Final Four was South Carolina, and their best just isn't as good as the other three teams that were there.
I definitely agree with that. I mean, you could argue that maybe North Carolina wasn't playing their best in November. They were just better than everyone else because they were a team that had been together.
That's fair.
I mean, at the beginning of the year, nobody really knew what this team was. People knew they had talent, but without Paige and without Bryce Johnson, Justin Jackson had a tremendous year, but he really underachieved his first two seasons from what most Tar Heels fans expected. I know going into the season, I didn't have the highest hopes for this team, but they're a scrappy team. They fought hard, and I mean, there's not much else to say about it. It was ugly basketball for a lot of times, but it was just enough to win. And what you can really point out in the tournament for them was late game situations. They always seem to just be that much better than the other team, because most of their games were very close. Like, you think about the Arkansas game, I don't think Arkansas scored in the last 5 minutes. Then the game against Oregon, even though they missed the two free throws, they got the offensive rebounds, and they just squeaked that one out. And then in the finals, that big block with 20 seconds left, I think, on Williams-Goss.
Yeah.
I say that was their staple, was the last minute, 5 minutes of the game. They
buckled down.
They showed what they were.
Yeah, and yeah, I think they were probably the best team throughout the course of the year. Gonzaga was pretty close as well, but that's always good to see, because you don't always get to see that in college basketball. And the other thing that we should mention is that I think Roy Williams has set himself up to be in the conversation as a top five coach of all time. Most national championships at North Carolina, passing the great Dean Smith, who was always very reveled there, and he was actually Roy Williams' mentor, so that is something to mention as well. But I think we should transition over to something that I am so excited to talk about. I've been licking my chops for a while. This is up there with my favorite. I don't even know what to call it. I'm talking about the NBA draft, and now that college basketball is over, we get to dive right into it. I know the NBA playoffs are right around the corner, and we'll get to that later, and we can talk about that for the next couple of months, but I think this is a good time to give a primer for the elite players in this class. I know we'll probably develop some sleepers later as we look into players more, but the top 10 is where we got to turn our attention to first, and for me at least, my attention goes right to Markelle Fultz. He's number one on my esteemed big board. And I think his combination of length, ability to create, he's not a bad he's a pretty good shooter, and just his athleticism is what puts him over the top over a guy like Lonzo or Josh Jackson for me.
I think another part of it, at least in my mind, is still the baggage that does come with Lonzo. And as much as you know, people may like, I know a lot of my own friends have interest in LeVar and what he's able to build as a brand. But I think the bigger thing is that, you know what you're going to get out of Lonzo, but you're not exactly sure what's going to come trailing right behind him. So I think not only is Markelle Fultz extremely talented, but in a way he's a safer first pick, just in that he isn't going to provide some kind of off the court distraction in whatever way.
I tend to agree with you in that sense. I also think Fultz is the consensus number one for most teams.
Yeah.
Really, when you look at his length, he's got a 6'10" wingspan. When I originally was doing some research for the draft, I did not expect that. I feel like he just is a little more dynamic than Lonzo Ball. Lonzo Ball, everyone wants to compare him to Jason Kidd, but Markelle Fultz can do everything. Sometimes Ball looks a little like he doesn't care as much on the defensive end. Now, UCLA as a team doesn't really play defense, So I'm not really going to fault him there. We have to see what he can do at the next level. Fultz was kind of the same. There were some times he looked disinterested, but he showed some really good flashes defensively. What really worries me was Lonzo Ball's pick and roll. UCLA does not run a lot of pick and roll, whereas Washington, because it seems like they understand that they're never going to be a good team, but they always pump out good draft picks, they play a ton of pick and roll. And I cannot remember the stat, but the turnover percentage for Lonzo Ball in the pick and roll was staggering. And when I remember when I saw that, I thought, there's no way he goes first overall. When teams watch him play pick and roll, I think that really hurts him.
I mean, I think you're helping and you might actually be helping and hurting his argument there, because saying he doesn't run a whole lot of pick and roll might actually be to his benefit, because I think that's kind of what you want him to do, because I think his number one skill is decision making, because he's a very smart player. I know that I didn't see that stat, but I bet it's true. But he does have his flaws, and I think he's a guy who I think he's just going to be. I almost feel like he needs to be catered to a little bit more, have the right pieces around him as opposed to Markel, which is a little different in that sense, I think.
I agree. I think everyone for a long time, I see a lot of Lakers fans really want Lonzo Ball. I don't know how he would fit on that team if they want D'Angelo Russell to play point guard, unless Russell's going to move over to the shooting guard.
That's what they've been experimenting with.
But Luke Walton has also said in the past that he wants Brandon Ingram to play some point, and Clarkson plays point for them sometimes. It's really odd what they do at that position.
The Ingram point that you brought up is that he's not going to be the actual point guard. He's just going to be able to like bring the ball up, and he's a good playmaker. So I don't
point
think
forward.
That, yeah. And it's yeah, that's just a couple I mean, I don't know.
Well, not to mention, I still think it's almost unlikely at this point, at least in my mind, that the Lakers end up in the second pick.
Yeah, that can't be forgotten. Because we were talking before we pressed the record button that Phoenix is probably, I haven't looked much into this because it hasn't really piqued my interest, but Phoenix is up there with some of the best tank jobs of the last decade, for sure, losing 12 straight.
Incredible. I mean, the fact that they had a 70-point scorer in a game and are still in the midst of what will be eventually. They're clawing back now, only down 9 in that game against Golden State, but likely to lose 13 in a row. Just one of the best tank jobs I've ever seen in this league over the past, I guess, 5 or 6 years when tanking has become so prominent.
Well, and as we kind of mold the two topics, the draft and the Suns, a guy like, if they do land in that number 2 spot, a player like Lonzo, I don't know how well he fits. I guess it's whether they think Eric Bledsoe is there for the long term or whether they're going to try and move him either during this offseason or during next season. Because they also have a player like Tyler Ulis, and you might scoff at that, but he was pretty good this year. I don't know if he'll ever end up being a legitimate starting point guard in this league, but he's shown little flashes. And the player that I think I like even more than Lonzo is Josh Jackson. I'm all for him. He's number 2 on my board, and I think even if the Lakers don't like Lonzo, I think Jackson could fit there. I think he could fit with the Suns. I think he could fit with Boston. Well, Boston's weird. Boston doesn't really need anything. They just are going to take the best player available, which I guess isn't a bad problem to have. But yeah, I'm all aboard the Josh Jackson bandwagon. I think he's going to be a better pro than he was a college player.
See, I disagree with that point. I think Boston could really use a big man. But with this draft, you cannot really make an argument for a big man.
Yeah, because like Lauri Markkanen's like, he's...
I wouldn't take him over the top couple of point guards.
Right, and he's... At this point in his career, when they kind of want to win like now and in the future, he's not any better than Kelly Olynyk is based on just NBA experience and stuff.
No, for sure. And Kelly Olynyk's a proven commodity.
Right.
But saying that, he's a free agent this year.
They also have Jurebko, who's fine. But Markkanen doesn't
really
move the
needle. World would lose its collective mind if, A, they took one of the bigs in this draft at number 1 overall, or 2... drop back from that number one spot to take a player and that pick, which would honestly, I would literally ask for Danny Ainge's job if that was the case, knowing that Paul George was available at the deadline, and they didn't want to move it because of that pick and for other reasons, but mostly because of how great that pick could be. In my mind, what could be maybe even a more likely scenario is taking Markelle Fultz and deciding then what to do with Isaiah Thomas. While Isaiah Thomas has done a lot to make this team as great as it is, I think he's a more movable commodity and one that could actually turn into something of a real asset more so than that first pick or trading down.
Well, I think the first pick could still probably net you more, because I don't know. You could probably trade that first pick and get George or Butler, and I don't know if you could trade Thomas and get George or Butler to that same extent. But I think the argument for that is valid, just because Thomas, he is an upcoming free agent. He's 28 right now. Do you want to be paying him $40 million when he's 33?
Agreed.
So I think that's a real argument, and it's crazy to say after Boston fans are head over heels for this guy, but they just don't want to be stuck in the mud with him when he's, because there's also a history of short guys not performing super well into their old age.
I mean, if the talk is, you know, as much as it's become, like, they don't want to necessarily succeed during this time of LeBron, which I guess at this point might seem a little crazy, seeing as they were number one in the East for a period of time, then maybe looking to the future is your better move. But even if that's the case, then, you know, it becomes a question of whether Horford should even be on the roster. So, I don't know. I think they do have a lot of questions to ask of their own roster before they do make any type of move. But I still think you take best talent available, and that is Markelle Fultz.
And we're saying this as they're a game back of the number one seed in the East, which is pretty crazy. Yeah, and
absolutely.
So now the thing for Boston is, though, as far as Thomas has taken them, he will be the thing that holds them back from going any farther. Because he cannot play. He's a top 10 worst defensive player in the league.
Oh.
If you look at any of his defensive stats, they're horrendous. And when you get to the playoffs, what did he shoot in the playoffs last year? It was, I believe it was 40%, maybe under. When teams have time to prepare for him over the long haul, and because he cannot play defense, he's gotten this team to where they are, but he kind of is the guy that's holding them back a little bit. Because I don't think they can really succeed with him. Not with his defense, and not when teams have time to prepare for him.
I think him being top 10 worst player might be a little bit of hyperbole, but I do see that as a good point, just in that, yeah, I don't know. When you have a set defense around you, I don't know how much he can really do, but we also have never seen him play this well. He's averaging 29 points a game. And especially come the fourth quarter, he's been huge. So I think Boston going in the playoffs is extremely interesting, and it just all comes back to Brooklyn, and it's hilarious that they are fighting for the number one pick and fighting for the Eastern Conference title.
Look, I think I agree with you. It's funny, but I take solace in the fact that we still do have two first round picks in this year's draft. I think that's huge, and as we've seen as of late. So this is a 6-4 team in the last 10 games, and one that's consistently fighting when healthy. Jeremy Lin has been a huge X factor for this team, and I'm not saying he's the answer, but putting someone competent in the point guard position and just kind of surrounding Brook Lopez, who's kind of vaulted himself probably into a top 10, top 5 center category over the past month or so. I think you can really, really be pleased with the job that both Kenny Atkinson and Sean Marks have done over the course of this season and kind of moving ahead as a team.
To be fair to that, both of those picks are going to end up being in the 20s.
Yeah, absolutely. But
and you, there is value to be found there.
Absolutely, this is one of the deepest drafts.
But when you look at their draft history,
right. Well, this is New York for you.
This is podcasting at its finest, but we can keep going. We'll play through the noise.
Yeah. When you look at their draft history in the 20s, they've picked, like, Juwan Johnson. they picked Mason Plumlee and then they traded him away. Chris McCullough. There's not a lot there to show that they have had success in those late first rounds.
I don't. But that's also a different regime. This is Sean Mark's first year.
It is, and what they've done has been impressive. But I don't. I think if they don't come last next year, I'll be shocked. I really admire the way that they fight, but it does come down to talent sometimes.
Well, but you're making two different arguments here. You're saying that you're unsure of Marks' drafting job when we haven't seen him really do it yet, and at the same time you're saying that this team has no talent. And I agree with the talent point. I think based on what I've seen from Marks, I give him the benefit of the doubt because I think he's a really smart guy, and I think they made the right hire there.
But is it not the same ownership?
Yeah, but they're not the ones making. I mean, they made, if anything, they're writing the ship, right? They are the ones that put these guys in charge. As far as the decisions down the line in terms of scouting and drafting, that's totally been left up to Marks and Atkinson. And you've legitimately seen improvement. Well, I mean, this team is only going to win 20 games this year. This team is also fielding a team of 10-day contracts. And to say that, while these two picks in the early 20s to late 20s may not have that much of an impact, what it does have in this deep of a draft where you can get someone like Kennard or even Swanigan, who would be an interesting pick late in the first round, it's going to come down to what Marks can do. And I think as of what we've seen this year, he's made smart decisions. He can run a basketball team.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's still going to be a bad team next year. Don't get me wrong. If they'll be the worst, we'll have to wait and see, really.
Well, the only reason I say I think they'll be the worst is because the other worst teams will legitimately improve.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you go by the general consensus of Lonzo Ball, let's say, going to Phoenix, and then they ship out Bledsoe somewhere and they get something back, their team is a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
With the Lakers, you add Josh Jackson to the Lakers, that team is legitimately better. The improvement for Brooklyn is very slight compared to the other ones. I think they would come last. I'll be shocked if they don't.
The team that I would put in that same conversation is actually
Orlando.
Think the Magic are close, yeah. And the Kings are close.
Yep.
But I
think it totally depends if they end up putting someone over Vlade as far as the Kings go. But I think. I mean, it's most
is
likely.
Is Hinkie a good idea?
I really like it. My dream for that team is that Hinkie comes in, totally changes the way he goes about the process, and goes all in on guards, only guards for the next 4 years. I think that might be the move. If he's going in a different route, I mean, they already have the bigs for one. And two, if this is going to be a guard-driven league, it makes sense for Hinkie to be ahead of the game and trying to just put his team around field the team around Buddy Hield and trying to shoot as many threes as they could a game.
I like that plan. If they were to do that, I mean, Macklemore, I believe, had 25 points the other night. So who knows, maybe he's showing signs of life now that he's going to
be. Are you still on that bandwagon, or is that completely empty?
Of the Macklemore bandwagon?
Yes.
When you see the flashes, you want to say that there's talent there. And he's not. It's not like he's super old. He might be the same age as Buddy Hield, if I'm not mistaken. Is he only 22?
He is 23? 24.
24? It comes down to consistency, and the problem is with Sacramento, they keep changing coaches. So you
I
never
think
get,
Jaeger's going to be there for a while.
I do too. But his first couple years, did he not have three coaches in by the time he was in his second year?
Carl,
Malone,
Malone and Corbin. Yeah.
Yeah, and now he's on Dave Jaeger. So that kind of inconsistency with what they want to do, that can be problematic. So if I'm not going to say I'm on the bandwagon, but I haven't just completely written him off as a flop yet. I would like to see what he can do under Jaeger.
I like the idea that they could end up with Monk on the team, you know. I think having
Yes, here we go. Now we're talking. Yeah. I love Malik Monk. If I think
put Monk at the one with Buddy Hield at the two, and that's a pretty exciting duo.
I'm very excited to see him. I think he's either going to be Ben McLemore or he's going to be really good.
and there's no in between.
Yes, no in between. I think he fits basically any team from 4 to 8. Just because every team needs a shooter. He is that height thing we talked about last week, I think it was, or the week before that, still is really weird to me. But I think he's still a really talented guy who can start scoring very easily. And it's just going to be whether he can create his own shot off the dribble for him to be a 19-point-a-game scorer.
I really like him on Philly, too.
Yeah, yeah, that's been like the pick that I've always been pointing to. So when you said him to Sacramento, it was just a little bit different. So for you guys, are Markel, Lonzo, and Josh Jackson your top three?
I think it totally depends on who ends up in that third spot. I think Tatum fits in a lot of different places, and I'm obviously as a Duke guy, I think he's and seeing a lot of him, I think he's got the type of NBA game that a lot of teams are looking for. If it is someone from late in the lottery that ends up in the top three taking the Lakers spot, I could see maybe. I think it'll be close no matter what. I think Jackson probably ends up there because people are a little bit more sure of what they're gonna get. But I still think that long run Tatum fits in a lot of schemes.
The reason I did ask was because I was wondering who number four is for you guys.
Guess
you answered that.
Yeah.
For me, it's I agree 100% with Dante. It's going to be at the three. I agree. It's probably going to be Jackson.
So then Lonzo's number two for both of you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And then,
unless
and
something then weird goes on at the combine.
Right. And that it's possible with that family for sure. But Tatum's your number four.
Yes.
Yeah, he's a very interesting guy. I think he's just a scorer. It's just what he does. He's going to be able to do it. I think his floor is really, really high. The curious thing is his upside, just how good can he really be overall. And I think he's probably number four for me as well. I haven't sat down and just ranked them in my head, but I know who like the top seven guys are for me, and he's certainly in there, no doubt.
The one question mark with Jackson over Tatum is Jackson's shown a little more flash on the defensive end.
Oh yeah, his upside on the defensive end is elite defender.
Yeah, so that for me that's what separates them. That's why I would probably take Jackson third over Tatum.
I haven't watched enough Jason Tatum defense to know if he's going to be like a sieve at the NBA level or if he's going to be serviceable, because he's not the most athletic guy, but I think he is.
But he's long and he's very strong for his age, and he's got length. So I don't.
Yeah, he's got that NBA body.
He's not going to be a guy that people can just pick on whenever they want. I don't think. But I don't ever see him being a big time defender. Who knows? He could turn out into one. He's got the body. I don't know if he has the athleticism.
No.
But.
Well, and another guy who I think is going to be jumped into this discussion, and hardcore draft Knicks absolutely love him, but not everyone else knows the name, is Jonathan Isaac, because he's near the top there too. He's, talk about length, he's 6'10", and he can legitimately play the three at the NBA level, which is surprising. He can shoot. He has, like, if you were just going for a wing on paper, he checks all those boxes that you want, and I think he's a guy who can factor into this discussion.
I don't know if I'd put him in my top five. I have him falling. I'd put him 5 to 10, and the reason being is his frame at this point. I don't know where he's so skinny. And I mean, people say the same thing about Kevin Durant, but he's not nearly as skilled as Kevin Durant.
Kevin Durant is different than everyone else.
Yeah, so you can't really Because I've seen people online try and compare him to that, but you can't do that. And I don't know if he has the ball skills to be a three yet. And he is so thin that there will be some question marks about him playing a four at the next level. But when you're that tall, that long, that athletic, and you can shoot the ball like that, he'll go top 10, I think.
Yeah, opinion. I think he's in that top seven for me. I think I'll put Tatum at four. I think Fox at five, Monk at six, Isaac at seven, and then Markkanen and Smith at eight or nine. I'm not a big Dennis Smith guy. I don't know if that's just because I haven't watched him quite as much as these other guys, because he wasn't in the Pac-12 and he wasn't playing in the postseason, so maybe I'll fall in love with him once I dig deeper as the draft approaches. But I think those nine guys are in there for me. There's a 10th guy who I'm forgetting, who I see like the top 10 of every mock draft is the same and I can't remember.
Frank Ntilikina.
Yes. Yeah, he's 10th for me.
I really know, I know nothing about him.
He's an interesting prospect. He's got great size for his position. And when you watch him play defense, it really makes your mouth water when you think what teams could do with him.
Doesn't he as a prospect, he reminds me of what we thought of Exum as.
Very similar.
That's not fun. I mean, as a prospect, I guess.
But as a prospect, everyone thought Dante Exum was can't miss, and then injuries have kind of played their part, and some inconsistent play, and the fact that he plays for a good team, doesn't get a lot of minutes. But as a when you look at it as a prospect, I agree. I think Dante Exum's a fair comparison. The problem is his ability to actually handle the ball at the next level. He turns the ball over a lot, and not because of careless decisions, just because of a loose handle, which is concerning.
Yeah.
So I could see him being in the top 10. I could see him falling out of the top 10. I agree with you about what's his name?
The guy Dennis from North Smith?
Carolina. Yeah, Dennis Smith. He seems to have fallen down a lot of people's draft boards. I remember a couple months ago he was a consensus top 5 or 6, and now he's
that typical like 6'3". I think, is he that tall or is he shorter? I feel like six three
is pushing it, but 6'2", 6'3".
Yeah, he's that typical just really athletic guard, isn't a great shooter, and has upside, but we just don't know what he's going to be able to do if defenses kind of push back on him. And his defense is a little shaky at this point because he wanes in and out in terms of his focus. But man, it's crazy how deep this point guard draft is, and just once this draft is over, there's going to be very few teams with not serviceable starting point guards.
I think we're almost at a saturation point anyway. The unfortunate thing is probably that my Nets are one of the only ones left that don't really have that point guard of the future or point guard now. But I do agree with you that it is guard heavy. One point that I quickly wanted to make is that just kind of looking at some other people's big boards and kind of getting a full-on feel, that there is just so many of these lottery picks are freshmen. Do you guys think that it would have made a difference if these guys didn't have that year of college and just did it just actually had the chance to come out last year and were ready just coming out of high school, or was a college year ready? I mean, Markel Fultz didn't even make the tournament and he's still gonna be the number one pick.
I think for each guy it varies. I think at the beginning of last season, I believe Markel, at least for Draft Express, which I think is a pretty reliable source, I think he was the number one pick at as the season was starting. So I think he's still in that same spot. But a guy like Lonzo was maybe 7 or 8. So his season has boosted people's stock and people are falling in love with him now. It just varies pick to pick. Yeah. And I don't know. I would like the high school or 2 year rule to be put in place, but I think everyone's been mentioning that and it's kind of a stale issue almost at this point.
Yeah.
I don't see that rule going anywhere anytime soon.
The thing about it is that it's not college's choice, it's the NBA's choice.
Yeah.
which I think is good, because there's many people who do agree with the point that I'm making, which means that there could be some movement in it, but the collective bargaining agreement just happened, so I don't know how much movement we'll really see in the near future.
Well, what I'm thinking is that the possibility exists that over the next 7 years, we've had this conversation before, and I think I'm more of an optimist than most people in this, that they can develop the D-League in such a way that it is actually possible and good for these high school players to come right out, spend some time in D-Leagues because they have legitimate contracts, make some money. Yeah.
You see that happening already. There's the
two-way contract. I want
to
contract.
Say his name's Terrence Ferguson,
yeah.
Yeah, was he supposed to go to SMU?
Arizona.
And he decided to go play professional ball in Australia. For Adelaide. And so you've seen it in the past. I'm pretty sure Jennings did that.
Moutier
did the same thing. But Moutier Jennings. Did it because he had no choice. Because there were problems with his academic.
Yeah, he was supposed to go to SMU, I think.
Yeah, he was supposed to go to SMU, and then...
I see a trend here.
Well, most of these guys, I think the case is the academics.
Yeah.
They don't do it by... I mean, I'm sure... Because I think Moutier had, like, a... Did he make, like, $1 million or something off a shoe contract or something? I think, while he was over there? Okay. I vaguely remember that. I could be completely making that up.
I did not hear that. But I know that it was... Because when he came to the States, he ended up going to... a school that wasn't really a school, and so the credits didn't count for university.
Right, and that was a problem that DeAndre Ayton was worried about, but it seems like he's gotten that figured out. The guy who will be a top three pick in next year's draft unless he Harry Giles it.
Well, that was a problem for Thon Maker.
Right.
Was he not worried about that as well for a while?
I mean, he's the guy who I think is kind of bucked the trend in terms of getting into the draft without even having to go to the year of high school, because he went to the year of prep school or whatever. The prep school thing counted. I don't know the full details.
Yeah, he played the year of, or 2 years of prep school in Canada, in Orangeville.
Mm-hmm.
Orangeville Prep. I'm surprised that more guys haven't decided to do that.
Yeah.
If Thon Maker broke that rule, they could come to high school in Canada. There are a couple of programs in the Toronto area, Orangeville being one of them, that are pretty highly thought of. I mean, Jamal Murray went to that same school as Thon. I thought more players would have started to trickle up here by now.
I don't know. It's not many people think about it this deeply as we all do. The other thing, I know, Thomas, you have to run shortly, but real quick, I wanted to talk about the Zach Lowe story because it gets me really excited. I don't know how real the possibility is that it's even in the NBA ever, but it's one of the best ideas I've heard, and I know, Dante, you really liked it as well as you read the piece about it, and it's in terms of late game basketball in the NBA, in this scenario, to change it up, instead of having all this intentional fouling going on, the teams, once the first dead ball happens under 3 minutes, the clock just goes away, and you're probably saying, like, what does that mean? And it goes away, and the whatever the score is for the team that's winning, they just have to score 7 more points to win the game. So this, and if you intentional foul in this scenario, you're basically giving away points instead of time. It's kind of similar to baseball, where innings don't have a time limit; they just outs are valuable. Whereas in the NBA, time is valuable. So I think it's an extremely interesting idea, and it'll be tested in the TBT tournament, which is a semi-pro tournament, or I don't know what to put it, but the winner gets $2 million. It's becoming a pretty big deal at this point, and it was put together by, I don't remember his name. I'll look it up, but what are your guys' thoughts on it?
I'd have to see it in practice first. So the principle would be if, for example, the score is 99-94, it would be the first team to reach 106.
Yes.
Okay. I read the article, and it seemed, when I first read what the idea was, it seemed so out there and so drastic. I recommend for everyone to go read the article. It was very good. The way he puts it, I think it could work, and it is kind of an exciting idea. It's it's different. It could change the game completely, like the three-point line did. It could do not much. I would have to see it in practice for sure. I'd like to see maybe in the summer league. They could introduce it in that semi-pro tournament. But I don't think I'll pass judgment on it until I see it in practice.
I mean, I think I found it more fun than anything. I agree. I think it needs to first kind of play out and see what the actual ramifications of this type of decision may be. I think the one thing is I do like this idea of doing, he said 1/16th of the points
average NBA score.
Yeah, the average NBA score. I think that's great that he's kind of have some, he has some back.
And his name is Nick Elam. He's a 34-year-old middle school principal in Dayton.
There you go.
Just,
wow.
Just so people know. And,
about that. But yeah. I do think that going into this with a lot of data, he's clearly putting a lot of time and effort into this. So I do appreciate that it seems like the league is at least taking him seriously. I do kind of wish that, you know, this is something that maybe moves the needle a little bit as far as their decision making in these final couple minutes of games. Jeez. The problem has really gone quite out of hand at this point as far as fouling in late game scenarios and just the time it takes for a fan to watch the last 2 minutes, I think is something that the NBA should be a little bit more concerned with having. I mean, I'm sure it's great for the owners and great for the league revenue that they get to go to a TV break basically every 30 seconds with as many fouls and timeouts as that are called at the end of these games. But I think that the league does really need to consider ways that they can improve the game, not only for the players on the court who clearly have gone tired about this, but even for the fans and how their viewership can be improved.
Absolutely. And I think just different ways of testing this out are interesting and exciting. And I think I don't know when these 12 games that it'll be tested in are, but if it does, it's the summer. So I think if it does work out and there's actually a real possibility of it, I think you could see it maybe tested in the D League, which is kind of the NBA's gerbil in terms of that stuff, and or just in summer league just to try it out. But it's an interesting idea, and it's something that I had never even considered before.
It's definitely out there. It's pretty radical. I do appreciate the work that that Elam is his name.
Yeah, he's been working on it for nine years.
Yeah, the thing is, he backs it up with enough data and statistics that you have to take it seriously. So if it works in practice, then I'm all for it. If it turns out to be problematic, we'll want to
see. Part of the argument against it is just the old-fashioned nature of sports, where you have all these records set in place and these thrilling comebacks that have happened, even though they are very rare, and you just don't want to kind of throw off that balance.
Yeah, you get the Reggie Miller 8 points in however 9 seconds, yeah, if that rule's there, you don't.
Uh-huh. But I think it's will be something to watch. He notes how many people are going to be watching it this summer, including maybe even Adam Silver just tuning in to see how it works out. And it's honestly brilliant by the TBT, who their CEO, whose name is Jonathan Mugger, for him to implement it, because he gets a bunch of eyes to games that people wouldn't normally watch. So I think it's interesting. But I think that's just about going to do it. We were going to get to some playoff seeding matchups, but I think we can do that sometime in the near future before the playoffs do get underway. Do you guys have any final thoughts?
This was a statement game for the Cavs tonight. They were playing the Celtics and ended up winning by, I think, 23 points at the Celtics. That's a very important game for a team that's been struggling as of late. And I'm kind of excited to see them build on this game and see what they can do going forward.
I agree with that. Because right now it seems like the top four is up for grabs in the East, and then the bottom four are also up for grabs. So seeding is going to, these last couple games, seeding is going to be interesting for sure.
Absolutely. And the one other game that I'd like to mention is just Miami's huge win over the streaking Charlotte Hornets, which really hurts Charlotte in terms of their playoff chances, because they're now 2.5 back of the Heat and the Pacers, who are both tied at 38 and 40. Oh, and the Bulls. So that really hurts them, and it might put an end to their playoff hopes. But that was a huge win for the Heat. And
do the Heat not hold the tiebreaker with the Pacers?
Who?
Do the Heat hold the tiebreaker with the Pacers, if I believe?
Oh, I don't know. Go ask Matt Moore of CBS, who literally lives on tiebreakers. I have no idea. I don't have the brain space to keep track of every individual team's tiebreakers. And the other one is the Nuggets Blazers in the 8 seed, but with 4 games remaining in the season, should be interesting. Well, I think that's just about going to do it for us here. Thank you, Thomas, as always, for joining us.
Thanks, Thomas.
We will probably have you on again, probably sometime in the playoffs, and then for sure before the draft, once we're actually able to sit down and look at more prospects than just the elite. Thanks, Dante, as always, for getting back.
Of course.
Back in the groove. And we'll talk to everyone soon. Follow us on Twitter at Coast to Coast Pod, the number 2, not the word. Thomas has been linked enough. He doesn't have to spell it out again. But we really do appreciate everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you all later.